Next month, Governor Jan Brewer will leave her ninth-floor Capitol office after 6 years of leading state government. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Brewer's former communications director, Matt Benson, and Mario Diaz, former staffer for Governor Janet Napolitano, about how the past 6 years have gone. How was Brewer as a leader? What were the biggest surprises? And how have her stances on illegal immigration affected Arizona? Plus, we have an official winner in the race to represent Arizona's 2nd Congressional District. I'll ask Rebecca Sanders of the Arizona Republic about the delegation and how their roles will change in the next Congress. Also, national sportscaster Al Michaels got his start as a broadcasting student at ASU. Since then, he's called Super Bowls, World Series games, and is probably best known for the Miracle on Ice U.S. Olympic hockey victory. I'll talk to Michaels about his career, which he chronicles in a new book. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The United States and Cuba are taking their first steps toward ending a standoff forged during the Cold War. Moments ago, President Obama announced plans to restore full diplomatic relations by easing restrictions on commerce and travel in the coming weeks and months. The U.S. will also open an embassy in Havana for the first time in more than half a century. This follows 18 months of secret talks between the U.S. and Cuba. They included a prisoner exchange, Cuba's release of a CIA officer for the release of three Cuban intelligence agents. Here's President Obama.
This man, whose sacrifice has been known to only a few, provided America with the information that allowed us to arrest the network of Cuban agents that included the men transferred to Cuba today, as well as other spies in the United States. This man is now safely on our shores.
As Obama was speaking to the American people about normalizing ties with Cuba, Cuban President Raul Castro was addressing the Cuban people. He praised Obama's decision, however, added this caution.
Esto no quiere decir...
Castro says today's announcement does not mean that the most important issue has been resolved. The embargo, Castro says, that has to end. However, Castro said Obama's decision deserves the respect and recognition of the Cuban people. Back in the United States, Senator Marco Rubio, Florida, could not disagree more. The Republican lawmaker, who is also a Cuban-American, says Obama's decision rewards a Castro regime rather than holds it accountable for human rights violations.
This president is the single worst negotiator we have had in the White House in my lifetime, who has basically given the Cuban government everything it asked for and received no assurances of any advances in democracy and freedom in return.
Rubio says he will oppose the White House's bid to confirm ambassadors and fund U.S. embassies in the hopes of pressing his arguments on the Cuban issue. In a separate case, another prisoner has been freed on a humanitarian basis, Alan Gross. 5 years after he was convicted in prison for espionage, Gross was released. He was reported, though, to be in poor health. New calls today from the government to figure out a better way to deal with leaking tanks of waste at Washington State's Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Here's the latest from the Northwest News Network's Anna King.
At the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, there are 177 underground tanks of radioactive sludge. They're the leftovers from plutonium production during World War II and the Cold War. Some of these tanks are leaking hundreds of gallons of the sludge each year. And the Government Accountability Office is worried that the waste has been sitting in these old, battle-worn tanks too long. There's a massive factory under construction to bind all this hazardous waste into more stable glass logs, but it's been delayed for technical problems. The Accountability Office recommends that Hanford managers come up with long-term plans for storing this waste, like new tanks.
Anna King reporting. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Staples, offering in-store shipping for personal and business packages. Open 7 days a week with extended store hours and shipping supplies. Staples. Make more happen. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The Pima County Board of Supervisors has delayed a vote to implement a ban on hiring smokers. The board was scheduled to vote on the ban on Tuesday, but County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry asked the board to hold off until February while he gathers more information. The proposal would have the county government turn away job applicants who smoke and impose a 30% health insurance surcharge on current county employees who smoke or consume other tobacco products. The county estimates 32% of its more than 2,000 workers are tobacco users, and county health officials say the policy could lead to more than $1 million in savings annually in health care costs. A new report from Arizona State University says the Phoenix area housing market is closing out a relatively flat year, in which Mike Orr of the W.P. Carey School of Business says single-family home prices rose just 4% to $208,000. He says, though the number of sales was down 5%,
a lot of people who work in the industry would rather it was busy rather than quiet. But, the general public should not be alarmed. It's fairly normal, and home prices are nice and stable.
Orr says he thinks 2015 will be a little better, but does not believe it will be much more than a gentle improvement over this year. The co-founders of the Phoenix New Times are giving a $2 million gift to Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike Lacey and Jim Larkin sued the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office in 2007 after they were arrested for publishing details of a subpoena. Last year, they won a $3.75 million settlement in that case. They're using those proceeds to establish a chair in borderlands issues at ASU. The new program will focus on coverage of Latino and border issues. This is KJZZ News.
KJZZ is supported by the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at ASU, university-inspired non-credit short courses and lectures for adults 50-plus. Registration for spring classes begin in January at lifelonglearning.asu.edu.
It'll be a mostly cloudy day around the valley. We'll see some scattered showers, got a 40% chance of rain, and a high of 61 degrees. Look for partly sunny skies and a 30% chance of showers tomorrow with a high of 62. It's partly sunny right now and 57 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Jan Brewer has been Arizona's governor for 6 years, but she'll be leaving office next month. What did she accomplish? What controversies was she involved in? I'll talk with her former communications director, Matthew Benson, and Mario Diaz, a former staffer for Governor Janet Napolitano. Also, national sportscaster Al Michaels got his start as a broadcasting student at ASU. Over the course of more than 4 decades in the business, he's been the play-by-play announcer on Super Bowls and World Series games, but he's undoubtedly best known for calling the U.S. victory in men's Olympic ice hockey over the Soviet Union in 1980. I'll talk with Michaels about his long career and his new autobiography. Plus, there are a lot of holiday performances to choose from around the valley. Should we focus on quality, nostalgia, or tradition? I'll talk with commentator Robert Pala. We start today's program with news that there is officially a winner in Arizona's 2nd Congressional District as of about 1 hour ago. It's Republican challenger Martha McSally, who beat incumbent Democrat Ron Barber by fewer than 160 votes after a required recount. McSally's victory shifts Arizona's 9-member delegation to a 5-4 advantage for the GOP. With me to talk about that delegation and today's news is Rebecca Sanders, who covers Congress for the Arizona Republic. Rebecca, now that we know the outcome of this, with Martha McSally taking over the seat held by Ron Barber, what changes in general in the delegation? There were some who've criticized the conservative bent of some of the Republicans in the delegation. One would think Martha McSally, with a close victory like that, would have to sort of play the middle.
Yeah, that will be very interesting to watch what kind of course she charts as a freshman in this large Republican majority in the House and joining the Arizona Republicans. She will be representing a district that is essentially split right down the middle between Democrats and Republicans. So will she go for the more moderate stances, or will she side with some of Arizona's Republicans who take a very conservative stance on things like immigration and federal spending?
Now that we're seeing the Senate flipping to Republicans for the first time in a number of years, how does that change the roles that John McCain and Jeff Flake are going to play? Does it give them more influence? And I guess as an addendum to that, too, since the two were so heavily involved in pushing for immigration reform in a comprehensive fashion, does it bring that issue to the fore in more of a way for Republicans in the Senate?
Well, I think certainly one of the things we're going to watch is Senator McCain's taking the leadership on the Armed Services Committee, which is a dream job for him. And then it also in terms of immigration, sure, we are looking at immigration still being a very hot debate in Congress in this next term, especially since the parties have set up a fight over Obama's executive action on immigration in February. There will be funding running out for the Department of Homeland Security and a big battle between Republicans and Democrats about what to do about that.
And what about Jeff Flake?
Yeah, I think that Jeff Flake is definitely continuing to build his profile and work on his priorities somewhat in the shadow or following in the footsteps of McCain. But, he's continuing his fiscal conservative priorities in supporting cutting spending, but also charting a somewhat moderate course on things like immigration, which are important to him, which we saw him do when he was in the House as well.
Kyrsten Sinema was expected to have, one would have thought before who we saw some of her opponents, who they were going to be, it was thought that going into her second term, she was going to face a major challenge in November, and she didn't. For many, she's considered to be really one of the few superstars the Democratic Party has in Arizona. What do you think she's going to do to put more of her stamp on things going forward?
Well, I think the results of her reelection to a second term, beating her Republican challenger by something like 6 points, I mean, just shows this Democrat is pretty Teflon, and the party sees her as a rising star. So she was promoted within the leadership ranks, given more responsibilities for whipping votes, and I think she's just going to continue to build her profile, and who knows if we may see her try to take a bigger role nationally or build a profile that may put her in the running for Senate or some other bigger aspirations in the future.
Mm-hmm. John McCain has sort of set an unofficial record for the number of times he can appear on the Sunday morning talk shows, and I wonder, going forward, anyone else in the Arizona delegation that seems to be stepping out and speaking more? It did seem for a while Representative Matt Salmon was doing that. Based on covering the delegation like you do, are there certain leaders of the delegation or people who like to talk more and get in the mix of things as far as certain issues are concerned?
Well, almost all of them like talking. But Salmon, yes, I would say that he has really tried to be on the forefront, especially on really red meat issues to his conservative base, such as, again, opposing Obama's executive action on immigration and really leading in some ways the kind of conservative faction in the House. But we also should be looking at, for instance, freshman Democrat Ruben Gallego, who's filling longtime Congressman Ed Pastor's shoes in Phoenix. He is, Latino, Iraq war veteran, and incredibly ambitious. I think we're going to be hearing a lot from him in his freshman term.
Kyrsten Sinema certainly has set a tone for being someone who works across the aisle. Has Ruben Gallego been that type as well?
Well, I would say that given the makeup of the district he'll represent, which is heavily Latino, heavily Democratic, it's going to probably be evident that he will lean more towards the left and potentially govern in the way that Pastor did, which was very strong liberal principles. And we'll have to see if that suits him and he perhaps tries to climb the leadership ranks in the party in the House and stick with that, or if he tries to make some effort to reach across the aisle, build more of a bipartisan relationship so that perhaps he can run for higher office in the future.
Rebecca, finally, how closely are you and your colleagues watching to see whether John McCain decides to run for another term? And if so, and if he does not, rather, how that could shake up the delegation as well as people sort of scramble for a new position?
If he decides not to run, which looks increasingly unlikely, that will be huge news, and you will see probably several of Arizona's Republican congressmen, as well as perhaps candidates from other places in the state, really jump at that opportunity, and it's probably going to be a brutal primary. If he says that he will run for re-election, and it's hard to imagine he won't. He just loves his job. But if he does decide to run, I think there's a possibility we'll see a primary challenge. But given what happened in 2010 when he basically annihilated his Republican opponent in that race with you know, millions of dollars, it could be political suicide for someone to try and challenge him.
Rebecca Sanders is the Arizona Republic congressional reporter. You can follow her on Twitter at Rebecca L. Sanders. Rebecca, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now with Governor Jan Brewer leaving office next month after 6 years. We'll talk with Matt Benson and Mario Diaz about just how good or not so good the job she did was. That's still to come. Also today, just in, the U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for young immigrants known as Dreamers to get driver's licenses. Arizona had asked the court to allow it to continue denying licenses while the court decided whether it would take the case. The court said Arizona could still ask the court to consider the issue, but must issue driver's licenses in the meantime. We'll be following that, of course, the rest of the day during all our programs, including All Things Considered, later on this afternoon on KJZZ News. More of Here and Now still to come.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Checking some temperatures around the state right now. Partly sunny skies and 56 degrees in Tucson. It's cloudy and 31 in Flagstaff. Cloudy and 54 degrees in Casa Grande. Partly cloudy skies and 55 right now in Yuma. Not much going on in Valley traffic at this hour, but on the Red Mountain portion of the Loop 202, watch out for a crash blocking the westbound shoulder at McKellips. Partly sunny skies right now, and it's 57 degrees in Phoenix at 11:17.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Next month, Governor Jan Brewer will hand over the reins of state government to Doug Ducey after 6 years in office. In that time, there have been huge budget deficits, Medicaid expansion, the finger wag at President Obama, and lawsuits related to illegal immigration. But how has Brewer done as governor? What has been accomplished? Where were the failures? With me to talk about those things are Matthew Benson, former communications director for Governor Brewer and now a director at the public affairs firm Veritas, and Mario Diaz of the public affairs firm Mario E. Diaz and Associates. He formerly worked for Governor Janet Napolitano. Mario, A to F, what grade do you give the Brewer administration?
Governor Brewer's staff is probably one of the best that I've seen and worked with. So I give them a very strong B+, and beginning with Ms. Klein as the chief of staff.
Ivan Klein, yeah.
And everyone else, including Matt. For the governor herself, I will say I'll give her a C-. You know, I was very impressed with her when she inherited the financial mess, quite frankly, from my former boss. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of undone business. And I really appreciated the way the governor came in and took leadership. Unfortunately, I think she got caught up in the... she was starstruck to a certain extent and got caught up with this knee-jerk reaction we call immigration. And from there, it just seemed that things somewhat derailed.
Mm-hmm. Matt, what are your thoughts on, are there certain things that you felt like were major accomplishments and things that were could have been minor or major disappointments?
Certainly, she came in, as Mario mentioned, with the largest challenges, I think, that any Arizona governor has faced in memory. In terms of a budget shortfall approaching $4 billion, almost half the general fund, which is usually between $8 and $9 billion. So enormous fiscal challenges, the immigration issue that was, you know, roiling and continues to this point. I think that she gets exceptionally high marks in terms of putting the state on at least a stable fiscal footing. And in terms of not kicking the can down the road, whether you're talking about taking on the temporary tax increase with Proposition 100, as she did at the same time she was running for election. So tremendously not the sort of thing you see every day. And then toward the end of her tenure with Medicaid and seeing that through, I think that these are legacy issues for which she will be remembered, certainly alongside immigration.
One of the things that she was criticized for is not being a great communicator, except really, I think, with Proposition 100, she was really out front on that one. How important is it for a governor to communicate regularly? Even if Governor Napolitano perhaps was not a great communicator either, she held regular press briefings. Was that something that was lacking in the Brewer administration?
Yeah, well, Matt was a great communicator. He did a wonderful job. Look, I can say this. The Brewer administration, the legacy is a legacy of contradictions. At points, she was a star. She vetoed this 1062 bill. She did have the guts to put on the table the tax increase. But yes, she got caught up with the national political scene on the immigration issue, which is not just about targeting a community or hurting a community. It hurt the state. And in public relations-wise, and economic, financial, our state took a step backwards. And I think she lost momentum there. And in terms of the communication, yeah, from an outsider, sometimes it felt like there was a hunker down mentality for whatever reason. And that's a personal philosophy. Napolitano was not that way. Napolitano was all about weekly chats with journalists and a lot of public speaking engagements.
Matt, as a former journalist yourself, in any way does an administration owe more public speaking from a governor or leaders in an administration?
I think there should be a basic expectation of transparency as much as possible. And, you know, every administration comes in and says it's going to be the most transparent in history. Certainly we saw that from the Obama administration. And then you usually, the reality is something different. And we've seen the media nationally be very critical of the Obama administration, saying it's, in fact, the least transparent they've worked with. So, but every governor is going to communicate in different ways. I was a part of countless of these weekly press briefings that Governor Napolitano did. And I thought those were generally helpful and in a lot of way kind of helped her steer the conversation. But the media, the climate, the community, it has changed. And it changed significantly from when Governor Napolitano was in office to what we have today. Newspapers that covered Governor Napolitano in some cases no longer even exist, whether you're talking about, the Tucson Citizen or the East Valley Tribune is certainly a much different publication than what it once was. So the traditional media matters less, and some of these other means to reach your constituents matter more. I mean, Governor Brewer has hundreds of thousands of Facebook followers. She has tens of thousands of followers on Twitter. When she tweets something, it makes news. And so she has other outlets to communicate with the public, and ultimately that's what it's all about, whether you're talking about a traditional news conference or something else.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. That's Matthew Benson, former director of communications for the Brewer administration. He's a partner with Veritas now. Also, Mario Diaz, former staffer for Governor Janet Napolitano. He is the principal at Mario E. Diaz and Associates. Mario, let's come back to the budget specifically, because I think that's a major point that we're returning to now as Doug Ducey's ready to take over as governor. What do you think about the way the governor handled the budget, how she handled dealings with the legislature?
She was handed a very difficult situation, and in short order, she took charge. And for that, I say I'm very proud of her, very proud. And I tweeted that, regardless of political party, I only want, Arizonans want the best for our state. And so she came in and handled. Subsequent to that, the issue of putting money in the rainy day fund versus investing, that to me, once again, it's a philosophical approach. I think perhaps investing in pre-K education or other social programs at a time when our many families were in need is an option that perhaps others could have taken. But overall, I would say she did the best that she could, and on the economy, I give her a B+.
A quick follow-up on that. As far as her priorities were concerned, no question she came into a dire situation, and cuts had to be made. Were cuts made in the right places?
I don't think we had a choice, and it's the same thing with the Ducey administration. There are going to be very limited choices for this governor-elect to make. We could, as outsiders, as citizens, we could want and desire, but the reality is we're going to have to tighten our belts even further. So, yes, I think the governor had the best intentions, but the finances dictated policy.
And how about in general the relations with legislative leaders? There were the feelings that this might be a slam dunk because you've got, of course, Republican majorities, in some cases supermajorities, working with a Republican governor. Governor Napolitano, by some, was considered to be a backstop. How did Governor Brewer do as far as that was concerned?
From what I see within the Republican Party, there are more factions than there are within the Democrat Party and Democratic Party. And so, yeah, I think she handled things as well as she could, and thank goodness for those moderates that assisted her in several key votes.
Matt, thoughts on working with the legislature, and how much strategy went into that? Was the governor someone who made it clear to Tobin, Biggs, Adams, whoever was in there, that this was her point of view and this is how she was going to approach things?
Well, it's interesting. I think that's one of the areas where you saw the greatest growth in the governor, and I think where she surprised people the most. I was at the Arizona Republic covering the Capitol when Napolitano left to go back to Washington and Jan Brewer ascended to the governorship, and the assumption in many circles was that she was going to be a rubber stamp for the Republican majority and kind of be a pushover and go along to get along. And that is anything but what happened. Whether you're talking about with the sales tax that she pushed through with Prop 100 and vetoed, I think, five budgets until she finally got the referral through Medicaid, and we all know what happened there. And then some of the bills that she was that backstop, whether you're talking about guns on campus or the birther bill, or, you know, I could go on and on. There were lots of instances of this. And so it really went from this idea that she was going to be a pushover to, by the time she left office, the criticism, especially on the far right, was that she was too overbearing and too all-powerful, and so which was, interestingly, a criticism that had been made of Governor Napolitano.
How big a deal was the pointing at President Obama? How much of that was theater? How much of that was actual making a point?
Well, I can tell you that none of it was theater. I've been asked many times whether that was planned, and it certainly was not. The letter that she had written in advance of that meeting on the tarmac, yeah, that was planned. I saw what was written and knew all about that. But anything beyond that came as a total shock to me and to the governor herself, because I called her immediately after I saw the photo. She wasn't even back in the office yet. And I said, you told me nothing happened. What, I'm seeing this photo of you pointing at the president. And her reaction was, no. I said, yeah, I'm looking at it. It just happened, and it was lightning in a bottle from there.
Mario, did that hurt the state more than other things that were done?
Politics is all about perception. And besides the pointing of the finger, whether it was just her mannerism or whether it was a scolding in her mind, it hurt the image of our state. SB 1070 hurt the image of our state. So there were a series of high profile, maybe not too many, but just enough to cause concern, especially the 1070 amongst the Latino community,
yeah.
where you have half of the students in the state that are Latino. You know, and as that goes, the state's going to go. And I think that during those times, the political advisors, whoever they were, took center stage with her and convinced her that this was the best thing to do. And that really set our state back.
I want to dig deeper into immigration. And Mario, let me start with you on this. How could she have handled that better, even if her points of view were that illegal immigration is wrong, you violated the law by crossing the border?
Well, if she would have stopped at the border, I don't think that she would have had any problem. I mean, I'm a fierce supporter for comprehensive immigration reform with strong border protection, as a lot, many people are. But when you start talking about the interior and you start causing a panic where, you know, I'm standing at a Cox communications shop and an individual Latino is turning two boxes in because he's going to Utah because he's afraid. This causes problem for our economy. Forget it. Just forget about the people. It's think about what happened to our state with comments and signing of this bill. It set us back.
The governor obviously has not gone back on any of those things. She's still driving hard on the driver's licenses for so-called dreamers. Can you give us some insight about how important that issue was to the administration and the governor's point of view on it?
Obviously, it's important to Governor Brewer. It's important to the administration. I think it's important to a good many Arizonans across this state who care about the rule of law, who are concerned about violence in their communities, who are concerned about, you know, disregard for U.S. or for state law, and just don't like the changes that they've seen across the country and in Arizona. And That's, you know, when you talk about the image of Governor Brewer on the tarmac with the president and the finger wag, well, why did that resonate so strongly, not just in Arizona, but across the country? And I think it was emblematic of the divide that we see in this country. You have many people who were offended by that picture, and you have just as many who saw that and said, right on, because we don't like what's happening. We don't like the failure to secure the border. We don't like the Obama administration playing fast and loose with executive actions and going around Congress, which we see to this very day. And there's a lot of anger out there. This isn't something that's just a political ploy. It's real.
When you have a governor talking about heads in the desert, and I don't think anyone found heads in the desert because of illegal immigration crime, you start creating this division within the communities. And that's what I'm saying, is when this type of language, because she is our leader, and when she speaks, people listen. But when she speaks with misinformation or facts or information that's just not accurate or can't be verified, then this is where you start getting the division of Arizonans not working together. You start building these bridges. And I think this is what happened in 1070. And for that reason, the legacy for Jan Brewer within the Latino community and other communities is going to be one that she was one of the worst governors in our state.
Matt, what went into the governor, I'm going to say, siding with, though this could be nuanced, the Arpaio Pierce side as opposed to the Flake McCain side?
I don't know at what point you think that she made a decision to kind of be on Team A or Team B. I'll just say that, I think that she wanted to be fair. She wanted to side on the rule of law. She didn't want to be inflammatory. Now, we can go back and forth about things she said at different times where she maybe misstated something or said something that, you know, look, every elected official who's out there in the public eye and on the stage all the time is going to have things that they wish that they could take back. I guess I disagree with the notion that Governor Brewer found herself in league with Russell Pierce and Joe Arpaio and that fringe. I think what you saw in 2000, I think it was the 2013 State of the State, where she came out and said, look, if the president will make a good faith effort to secure the border in Arizona and secure the Tucson sector in the same manner that he has secured the Yuma sector, then I'll come forward, I'll come to the table in equally good faith, and we need to fix our immigration system. It's broken.
Matthew Benson is former communications director for Governor Brewer. He's now a director at the public affairs firm Veritas. Mario Diaz of the public affairs firm Mario E. Diaz and Associates formerly worked for Governor Janet Napolitano. A brief update on KJZZ News. The U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for young immigrants known as Dreamers to get driver's licenses. Arizona had asked the court to allow it to continue denying licenses while the court decided whether it would take the case. The court said Arizona could still ask the court to consider the issue, but must issue driver's licenses in the meantime. We'll keep updating you later on this afternoon. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A brief update. President Obama announced earlier today that the U.S. is normalizing relations with Cuba for the first time in more than 50 years. That'll include opening a U.S. embassy in Havana. We'll have more details coming up on NPR's Here and Now and All Things Considered later today. Earlier this week, Phoenix-based PetSmart announced that it agreed to be acquired for $8.7 billion by a group of investors led by BC Partners. The PetSmart buyout is the biggest private equity deal announced in the world this year. So what does that mean for the Valley, which already has a dearth of corporate headquarters? With me to talk about that, among other things, is Barry Broom, president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. So, Barry, to what extent does the PetSmart deal hurt the Valley business scene going forward?
Well, you know, we don't know what the outcome's going to be, you know, on the completion of it. So, you know, if it makes the company stronger and the headquarters stay here and it grows, then, you know, it helps the Valley. Obviously, if we lose the headquarters like we did in the U.S. Airway-American Airlines merger, you know, it's not as helpful.
Is there something about this community that is leading to these kinds of things? Is there something where we don't have enough of a presence? Obviously, people like to be here. Is there something that doesn't keep it keeps us from getting these headquarters and want to stay here?
Well, the headquarters are, we got Freeport MacMahon's headquarters over in New Orleans when they made the acquisition of Phelps Dodge.
Right.
So, headquarter decisions really are not as strategic as people think. Sometimes in the case of U.S. Airways and American Airlines, Doug Parker just put the headquarters to Dallas on the table as an inducement to help, with the transaction that he did with common shareholders and institutional investors. So each one of these are different. PetSmart was built here. So I think there's a good chance that the PetSmart headquarters will stay even after this acquisition.
How much weight do you place on the importance of having corporate headquarters in an area? That comes up a lot.
Well, I think, it's not nearly as important as people give it to, but it's a nice luxury. I mean, you take markets like Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Paul, they have a lot of companies headquartered there. And because those companies are headquartered there, their CEOs are more engaged in the community. So the big loss for us with PetSmart really isn't the jobs, because, we're producing a lot of jobs. It's the loss of the time and energy of people like Phil Francis. I mean, Phil Francis, when he was head of PetSmart, was a very active corporate leader on education and philanthropy and social causes. And, was a guy that just really gave back and cared about the future of the community. So when you have these corporate leaders, they're more apt to be engaged in your community. When you lose them, then you lose, obviously, a big name and a big stick. But since Phil's left PetSmart, PetSmart has gone dark in the community. And I would imagine, I had predicted a while ago, they had pulled back from all their community involvement, and I thought there was a possibility that they were in play as a company. But I think overall, having the headquarters from a leadership standpoint is very helpful. From a job standpoint, the reason Phoenix does so well on jobs is we're a great place to build and run businesses, and that's really a product of our overall policy position and the way at which we support and feature small businesses.
But what more needs to be done, Barry, to attract more jobs to this area? Does GPEC, for example, receive enough support? What has worked best for you? What have some of the challenges been?
Well, a lot of people have a hard time believing this, but we've attracted more businesses every year in the last 4 years than any market in the United States. And we attract more businesses than Dallas year in and year out. But, some of that has to do with the fact that our brand's been a little bruised from the politics in the state, so it's not something people think of or acknowledge us about. We kind of get overshadowed by these philosophical conversations on immigration and religious views. So the market's doing very well at attracting businesses. What we have to do to change the economy is really change the human capital or the talent equation. So we're not doing a good enough job at getting STEM education penetrated in our schools and then having those STEM programs aligned with industry strategies to our community colleges and our higher ed.
Okay, but one quick thing when you mentioned the education, Barry, because did some of the election results concern you or those in the business community? And the emphasis was on the superintendent of public instruction race, considering even just by perception how vital K-12 education is to attracting businesses. Would it hurt the area to have headlines like that? We don't really know Diane Douglas yet, but if some of the things are correct, are you worried about that?
Well, I think the problem that we already have Diana Douglas is already a failed leader, from my perspective, because what she's promised to do now is not talk. So when the state public leader on instruction has to manage the political fallout from her victory, saying, "Don't worry, I'm not going to say much." I mean, that's not exactly exciting news. I mean, I think going from Tom Horn to John Hoopenthal to Diana Douglas, to me, just demonstrates what a disaster it is to have an elected state superintendent. I can't think of anything more disastrous. And it really won't matter who gets elected. Eventually, they're going to be making political decisions instead of policy decisions that are good for education. So one of the things that I would encourage the new administration to think about, if they want to make schools better, one of the ways to do it is to get rid of that elected position, have an appointed superintendent with deep educational credentials, like most states, and have them report to an elected or an appointed state school board, and you're going to get a lot more of a relevant, intelligent conversation around the future of education in Arizona if you have a professional in that job instead of an elected official.
One more political question related to that, and then I'll let you go. Governor-elect Ducey has gotten high marks from some for having been a businessman, including the Coldstone experience. In any way, do you expect that to translate into better and broader economic and business leadership from state government?
I do. I will tell you, I think Doug Ducey's going to learn a lot in this job, and I think he's going to find out it's a very complicated job. But he's already done some great things, like appointing Kirk Adams chief of staff, who was a terrific Speaker of the House and a very young guy. So he's already surrounding himself with very good people. You know, he's going out and finding quality people. I know Doug is a very good, I've known him for 10 years. He's a very good person, very good human being, and he's going to want to do a great job in Arizona. I think the challenge for Doug Ducey is going to be rationalizing his experience as a candidate versus his experience as a governor. And what I found out, you know, being governor is a completely different world, and you're really not prepared to be governor until you are governor.
Barry, finally, you almost left for San Diego once. There are media reports you're going to leave. Are you staying or are you leaving?
I haven't really decided on that yet, so okay. I'm not making any public comments on that, if that's okay.
Barry Vroom, President and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. Thanks for squeezing us in, Barry.
All right, thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, legendary sportscaster Al Michaels has a new autobiography out. He got his start at ASU. We'll talk with him. Also, find out about some of the holiday entertainment in the Valley. And, of course, throughout the rest of the day, we'll be following the major news stories of this morning. The U.S. Supreme Court clearing the way for young immigrants known as Dreamers to get driver's licenses. Also, the U.S. normalizing relations with Cuba. All of that coming up later today on KJZZ. Stay tuned as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, managing the Valley's water long before it reaches our cities, so there will be enough water today and for generations. Learn more at togetherweconserve.com. SRP, delivering water and power.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. We should see cloudy skies in the Valley today, scattered showers with a high of 61. That's about 4 degrees below normal for today. Partly cloudy skies overnight with a low in the upper 40s and more clouds tomorrow. We've got a 30% chance of rain tomorrow, and we're expecting a high of 62 degrees. In Valley traffic right now on Grand Avenue, a crash is blocking the right lanes where it meets the Loop 101 Agua Fria Freeway.
It's that time of year again. You still have those hard-to-buy-for people on your list? Uncle Sid? Maybe your brother-in-law? Well, how about getting them a night of fun and frolic?
Where were you trained in massage therapy?
Chicago School of Massage Therapy.
Okay, is that legitimate?
Yeah. As much as your show is.
Oh, thank you so much.
Join Michael Feldman at the Chandler Center for the Arts live on February 13th. Tickets and information at KJZZ.org, made possible in part by Quick Lane at Santan Ford.
Partly sunny skies and 57 degrees in Phoenix at 11:43.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Legendary sports broadcaster Al Michaels has a lot of career highlights, calling multiple Super Bowls, covering the Earthquake World Series in the Bay Area in 1989, among others. But the casual sports fan probably knows his work best from the 1980 Winter Olympics hockey game between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. After a career that has spanned four decades, Michaels is going strong as play-by-play announcer for NBC's Sunday Night National Football League games. He'll be in the Valley over the weekend to call the Arizona Cardinals versus the Seattle Seahawks. On Saturday, he'll be signing copies of his new book, You Can't Make This Up, at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. I started my conversation with Michaels by asking about his intentions, even as a broadcasting student at ASU, to become a successful sports announcer.
I think it was more naivete than anything else, Steve. I was young, and anything is possible when you're young. You don't see the roadblocks that might be ahead. So I dreamed big. A lot of it came true. And I look back now and I go, wow, you know, that's pretty stunning, to the extent that if you could look back and say, well, I could have seen where the pitfalls were and the roadblocks. Maybe I wouldn't have been so optimistic and so sanguine about the future. But, you know, as a kid or as a teenager anyway, and I'm walking around the campus in Tempe, and I'm thinking, you know, someday I'm going to do the World Series, and someday I'll do the Olympics, and it all happened. But naivete is a wonderful thing, and I tell students these days when I speak to high schools or colleges, and they want to get into the broadcasting business. I said, look, it's a very rewarding business. It's a great challenge, but dream big. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, and just work hard, and hopefully the right things happen. And I wound up in the right place at the right time a lot, Steve, and I'm very fortunate in that regard. There's no doubt about it.
Al, I'm in my 40s, and for me, watching sports, not just growing up, but in the past few years and everything else, to me, the two best national play-by-play announcers are you and Marv Albert. When I listen to you guys, I think great voice, great knowledge, but also a personality, too. How long did it take you to feel comfortable being yourself on the air?
I grew up in Brooklyn, and I remember when Vin Scully started. He was the number three announcer for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And we all know that Vinny now is still going and will do another season of Dodger baseball next year at the age of, I believe, 87. And he sounds great. Everybody has a model, and I don't care whether you want to be an author or an artist or a singer. You probably want to sound or paint or write like somebody. And so for me, Vinny was that model, and I kind of patterned myself after him early on, especially at ASU when I was doing games on the campus station in the 60s. And then as you get more comfortable and you get more, as they would say in football these days, reps, repetitions, and you keep practicing, you begin to develop gradually your own style. So these days I would say, oh, there's probably some of Scully in me, but a lot less than there was early on because I've had enough experience. You go along and you realize what the best way for you to do the game is, and so it's an evolving process. It's something that I've done for my entire life, and it's one of those things that just doesn't happen overnight. You get more and more comfortable as you go along, and the audience gets more and more used to you, for better or worse, and that's how it happens.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with legendary sportscaster Al Michaels. His new book is called You Can't Make This Up. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix coming up on Saturday, December 20th, from 11 until 1. When you consider your career and people think of you Monday Night Football, Sunday Night Football, but no question, people who are not sports fans probably know you best from the Miracle on Ice in 1980. Did you ever think that you would be associated with that, and how did that change your career?
Well, the fact that I was given hockey to begin with as an assignment was a great story, because in those years, in 1980, hockey wasn't what it is today. Nobody really knew what offside or icing was. I did, and it helped me get assigned to it. I was on an all-star staff of announcers, including Jim McKay, Howard Cosell, Keith Jackson, Chris Schenkel. So any one of us, I guess, could have been assigned to hockey, but I got the assignment because I had done one game, and none of the other guys had done any games. I loved hockey as a kid, and then I wind up in a situation where it turns out to be what Sports Illustrated called at the end of the century the greatest sports moment of the 20th century. Pure luck, pure happenstance, serendipitous for me, and then to wind up there when that happened was just it's a rabbit's foot dangling from my belt loop, because who could have predicted that? Nobody. And then it happens, and it still resonates to this day, and it meant so much, obviously, to our country at that particular time.
Over the past 34 years, more than 1,000 times, fewer than 1,000 times, someone has asked you to say, do you believe in miracles?
Oh, many, many more than 1,000 times. It happens all the time. And I love it. I'll see a father who might be in his mid-40s, and he has in tow his teenage son. And he comes up and he says, oh, God, I remember where I was and how much it meant. And then the kid is into it, too, because the father has passed the story down to the son, and the son has seen the movie and maybe even the HBO documentary, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so everybody feels as if, even if they weren't there, they know the story and what it meant. It's one of those things where if you're old enough to remember it, you remember where you were. People always tell me that. And then you think of the events in our lifetimes. If you're old enough, you remember Pearl Harbor. Terrible. You remember assassination, terrible. You remember the Challenger exploding, terrible. You remember 9/11, horrible. This is someplace that you recall, or something you recall, where you remember where you were. Wonderful. So everything else is terrible, and this is wonderful, and that's why it stands alone to me.
Second-generation announcers, that's become a big deal. What are your thoughts about that and competing with folks who maybe got a little bit of a shine because their dads were successful?
Well, they grew up in the business, and it's, there are plenty of actors whose fathers were great actors and directors whose fathers were great directors, authors, you name it. It helps, obviously, to be a party to that. But I look at, you know, somebody like a Joe Buck. To me, Joe Buck is a terrific announcer. So, obviously, he's Jack's son. Jack was a legendary announcer, and Joe grew up in that household, and obviously Jack was a gigantic influence on him. But Joe is where he is today because it's a meritocracy. I mean, through the years, Marty Brenneman succeeded me in Cincinnati as the announcer for the Reds back in 74, and his son Tom has now been on national television for a lot of years. So I think for the most part, you know, maybe it helps early on, but you get to where you get because you've earned it. So maybe you did get a little bit of a head start and a leg up, but you only get to where you go eventually because of the quality of your work, and they deserve it.
Longtime national sports broadcaster Al Michaels. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore coming up on Saturday to sign copies of his new book, You Can't Make This Up. Then he'll call the Cardinals-Seahawks game at University of Phoenix Stadium on Sunday. Al, thanks for the time.
A pleasure, Steve. Good to be with you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. If you look online or pick up a publication that has a calendar or event schedule, you'll see a lot of holiday-themed events around the Valley. A lot. There are plays, musicals, concerts of all varieties. So we decided to call arts critic and commentator Robert Pala to get his perspective. He can be a bit curmudgeonly about certain things, but it turns out he's a big fan of the holiday season and some of the shows this time of year. Robert, are there some holiday events you look forward to every year, others where you say, I know why they're bringing that back, but I don't want to see it ever again?
There are things I look forward to every year. And you know, the thing that is true about holiday shows, not just here in the Valley, but everywhere, is that you make them a tradition and you go every year, and at some point they're going to leave you. So, you know, Actors Theater stopped doing Christmas Carol. They did it for 19 years. Yeah. It was their kind of their fundraiser so that they could choose really interesting shows all season long. They did a beautiful production. It was always evolving. The cast would change. The songs would change. They stopped doing it in their 20th year. Theater Works in Peoria started doing it, and their annual Christmas Carol got better every year, and this year they're not doing it. I know. So.
Well, why not? Why would they stop doing Christmas
Carol? I have
Carol?
No idea.
Okay.
And none of my business, I'm sure, but they're not doing it this year. They're doing a Christmas Cabaret instead. There is a Christmas Carol production at Fountain Hills. I can't speak for it.
Mm-hmm.
But Fountain Hills Community Theater is doing it.
Now, Christmas Cabaret it's not pre-World War II, right? It's not, like, based on the other cabaret.
No, it's not that cabaret. Christopher Isherwood does
Christmas.
Can't imagine
Christmas. The theme on that one, yeah.
there are things that do stay with us. Fortunately, we have the Nutcracker every year. We have Fran Cohen's Snow Queen, mm-hmm. based on Hans Christian Andersen's story, beautifully presented by Susie Silverman, the dancing. There's interesting stuff this year. There are new things this year.
Well, is there anything, you know, we've talked about Nearly Naked Theater in the past, we've talked about Stray Cat in the past. Is there anything of an edgy variety of Christmas theme?
Yes, there's a little company downtown called Space 55 Theater, and they are doing something called Bloody Merry Christmas, which is for people who do not like the holidays.
Okay.
I won't be going to that. I also will not be going to Sister's Christmas Catechism in Scottsdale.
You're not going to criticize Sister now, are you?
I really like the actress who plays her, and I liked the first show, but it's become, well, you know, it's... Yeah, this is not the best installment in that very long series. I did see it when it first played, and I probably reviewed it, but I won't be going to that. Unusual things, I think it's unusual that we have so very many. There's this new trend in musical Christmas musicals based on films. Mm-hmm. So the Palms Theater is doing the musicalization of Miracle on 34th Street. There's a musical review of sorts called White Christmas with Irving Berlin music, and it's based on the 1954 film. That's at Arizona Broadway Theater, which, you know, that's a professional company, so that's not... That's probably a safe bet. There was a Broadway musical based on the film Elf.
Oh, yes.
A couple of years ago, and Mesa Arts Center is doing that. That's been released to community theater, and they're doing that this year. But I always tell people to stick to the tried and true things if they're just getting started with holiday shows. Mm-hmm. Phoenix Symphony's Polar Express is a new tradition. I don't think that's going anywhere. I think that we're going to have that. Well, as I said, we'll always have the Nutcracker and the Snow Queen. If you have kids and you've got to take kids to a kids show, I always recommend Child's Play. We forget that this is a professional theater company. Mm-hmm. They do amazing work. Beautifully written pieces, nicely produced.
Are there any sort of Hanukkah shows? Are there any sort of Kwanzaa shows, anything like that?
Boy, there were. You know, when we lost Arizona Jewish Theater Company, we lost their Hanukkah show, The Odd Potato. I'm sure there must be something Kwanzaa specific, but I don't know who's doing it.
Okay.
I tend every year to think about the things that we don't have at Christmas time. I'm a glass half empty guy. So I miss The Odd Potato. I miss Actors Theater's Christmas Carol.
As far as the quality goes, is that important? Or, as you mentioned, you think the traditions are important. Can they balance out?
I don't know that it's a balance so much. I think this is maybe the only time of the year when it's okay to deliberately go see something lousy. Because it's about the tradition and not about the quality of the production or the performance that you are going to see. My husband and I go to one particular performance every year, which, you know, I'm not going to tell you which one it is, and it's always mediocre, and we never miss it. Every year. We've gone every year for, I don't know, 17, 18 years. It's just part of our holiday tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, the downside of this is that this, for some people, this is the only time of year that they go see a live performance, ballet, symphony, theater. Mm-hmm. And if they go and see something that isn't great, it might very well inform their idea of what live performance is about and how it always is. And of course, it isn't always that way. If you go see your granddaughter's Christmas pageant and it's a bunch of kids, you know, singing off key in paper mache costumes, it might very well affect your opinion of theater, and that's too bad.
I do wonder sometimes when it comes to this sort of a holiday-themed show, in some cases, is it just about feeling good when it's done, as opposed to seeing a real heavy drama and wanting it to challenge you and think about later and have big discussions with friends? With a show like some of these Christmas shows or holiday shows, it's just like, you know, it was nice. It was a nice sort of night. It was relaxing. We didn't have to think too much.
We are all too tired to do anything else at the holidays. I think even for people who don't celebrate one holiday or another in December, the tension is in the air, and you know there's more traffic, and there's more short-temperedness, and we don't need one more thing. So yeah, I think the idea of going to something that's just sort of light and fun is probably a better idea.
I'm putting you on the spot. Is there any sort of something, whether it's, you mentioned films that were made into plays or musicals, is there something that you've loved for years, cheesy, great, whatever, that you wish would come back in some other form at the holiday season?
I wish Actors Theater would do Christmas Carol again.
What made their production so good?
It was always evolving. They treated it almost like a blank slate every year. It was never exactly the same. And not just because they recast the show every few years, but because sometimes it was a play with music, and other times it was a full-on musical, and I don't know, there was something really gratifying, particularly for someone who goes to the theater at least once a week, to go to a really fine production and also be able to scratch off something from my list of holiday traditions. That was one of the things we went to every year, and we knew we were going to have a good time because it was going to be appreciably made.
Robert Pala, happy holidays.
Thanks, Steve.
God
you
bless
too.
Us, everyone. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks also to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond.
for their help on the program. If you missed any segments or you'd like to hear one of our past programs, go online later today to kjzz.org. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Cactus Pine Girl Scout Council, helping girls reach their full leadership potential to make the world a better place.